Hello, my name's Craig Barker. I'm the Head of Public Engagement at the Chow Chak Wing Museum at the University of Sydney. Welcome to Object Matters. Object Matters is a podcast that explores the relationship between a guest and museum collections more generally, or maybe even a specific object within the Chow Chak Wing Museum. For this particular episode, I'm thrilled to be joined by archaeologist Alice Stevenson. Alice is an Associate Professor of Museum Studies at the Institute of Archaeology at University College London. She has previously held posts as curator of the Petrie Museum of Egyptian and Sudanese Archaeology, as well as researcher in world archaeology at the Pitt Rivers Museum in Oxford. She's in Sydney at the moment for a number of different projects, but for the Chow Chak Wing Museum, it will be delivering the 2022 Sir Charles Nicholson Lecture. Welcome, Alice. Welcome to Australia.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Thank you very much for joining us on the podcast. I'm really keen to talk to you more broadly about Egypt, more broadly about archaeology, and more broadly about archaeology within museum collections as we go along. But can I begin by asking you to tell our listeners about your career? When did you first become interested in archaeology? You know, was it, like many of us, as a child going to see an Egyptian exhibition, or was there something else?
It's really hard to pin down. I was going to be a vet when I was a teenager. But when it came to the crunch and, you know, you get all those brochures for university and looking through courses, and I kept coming back and back to the archaeology page and I just thought, this just looks so interesting. And so I went with my heart rather than my mind, not thinking, well, what could the career after this be? Yes. Let's do something really interesting. And so I studied archaeology and anthropology at undergraduate. But funnily enough, never because I wanted to dig up anything.
Yes. Now, I want to talk to you about more about this as well, because, of course, the popular assumption is we're all out in the field all the time. But this actual concept of museum archaeology, which you've just edited a book on as well.
Yes.
But in terms of your actual academic career, so you did your doctorate at Cambridge?
That's right, after I did my museum studies master's. And I'd always been drawn to the objects that were produced in ancient times. And so for me, it was that encounter with the past that was the most important. I thought that's where I wanted to go with my career, was to work with this material from hundreds, thousands, or just even decades ago.
Yeah, yeah.
Great privilege to work with that sort of material.
Well, I mean, you've been fortunate in your career in terms of some of the remarkable collections that you have had an opportunity to play with as well. Again, we'll talk about this in more detail as we go along a little bit later in the episode, but there is, of course, a big revolution in terms of the way museums are operating. Museums have become victims of broader cultural wars, particularly noticeable in Britain as well. For someone who's teaching museum studies today, what is some of the advice that you would give to your students about the role of a museum in the 21st century and indeed the future of museums?
To always listen and to always challenge assumptions. I think that's one of the things teaching museum studies is that the course and the program has to change every year because there's different pressures and you're constantly unlearning as well as learning.
Yeah.
And so one of the things, the joy and the challenge of museums is that they are under scrutiny and in demand from so many different quarters. It's exciting, but it's also very challenging. And it's a huge responsibility. So really training students for me to have confidence in navigating and facilitating and stepping away from an older model of being expert. You know, you don't come to university to learn things to have expertise. It's about developing critical skills. And so that's really what I hope I can equip my students to be doing.
Surely a museum's a perfect environment for developing those critical skills, though, too. You've got the concept of object-based engagement and learning and research, obviously, but also those questions of developing a narrative and using the objects to actually engage with a culture that, many ways, is probably the perfect microcosm of understanding some of those bigger pictures, isn't it?
No, absolutely. And the range of skills and expertise, both professionally within the museum, but also in the communities that we serve as well. And so different forms of writing, different ways of telling story from the scholar through to a child's engagement, through to a specialist interest groups, to, you know, general family visits on the weekend. It's this full spectrum of engagement.
It's also interesting, I mentioned the culture wars before. I think that many of us in Australia are not necessarily aware of just how divisive the arguments become in the UK in recent years as well. We, of course, have had our own discussions in Australia, but in many ways, some of the issues that seem to be argued in the press, in particular at the moment in the UK, are things that we've moved on from in Australia without, you know, forcing you into talking about the politics of it all. But, you know, just in terms of an observation, it's clearly an interesting time for the museum sector in Britain at the moment. How is it coping?
A lot of people are under pressure. It's quite a stressful time, I think, for museum colleagues, because, for example, many of the examples we use when I teach museum studies come from Australia, come from North America, where there's a longer, perhaps, history of civil activism, of reclamation of indigenous rights, which we have not faced in the UK.
Yes.
We've not faced up to those colonial histories.
Yes.
And as, you know, myself, going through the education system in Britain in the, you know, 1980s and 1990s, just giving away my age, we just were not taught. So there is, particularly now that our Queen has sadly passed away, we are going to see another period of colonial nostalgia.
Yes. Yeah.
Without people really understanding the context, the,
yes.
the repercussions,
yes.
or the lived experience of those that continue to live with the after effects of that. And so there hasn't been a national reckoning.
Yeah.
I think it's a great challenge in the UK to face those histories. And I think that's a big barrier where many of the approaches developed in places where this conversation is more advanced,
yeah.
trying to import those same conversations into a country and into spaces that are have got a lot more work to do to prepare people for those conversations.
Yeah. I guess the museum is ultimately one of the best environments to have those conversations, however, in terms of that multi-voice approach that you were mentioning before.
Absolutely, I'd agree. But again, we've got a lot of work to do to manage expectations. We still have various publics coming in to be educated. The museums, surveys have shown, have great trust of their audiences. So that's a great privilege and responsibility for museums. So that questioning space can make visitors feel uncomfortable when they don't necessarily want to come in to question something.
Yep.
They just want certainty, and we are in times of great uncertainty.
Yes.
So managing that, I think, is going to be, you know, the strategies for doing that. Again, interesting times, and we're going to just keep trying and testing and keep trying.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's really the thing, isn't it? And as you were talking about before, about relearning those skills each time.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Museums, by their very concept, are, of course, colonial institutions, and the area that you have largely devoted much of your career to, that is the culture of ancient Egypt and pre-dynastic Egypt in particular, from your perspective, has such colonial legacies and baggage, for want of a better word. It's part of that broader conversation about museums in the 21st century. How may we learn from mistakes in the past made by museums and by archaeologists working in Egypt and do a better job going forward?
So I think this, again, is profoundly difficult for collections from Egypt because they're an iconic museum culture.
Yeah.
That Egypt comes to stand for the past. It's what I've called hyperreal. We're so used to seeing Egypt in the museum that we're really blind to the way that the museum has created image.
Yeah.
So again, we know that it's very popular amongst the visiting public. It's well used in marketing, in museum shops.
Yes.
It's a great draw.
Yeah.
But it's also taken for granted.
Yes.
It's really been quite a blind spot in museum practices. So we do see many museums, particularly anthropology or world cultures museums, as they're rebranding themselves at the moment, doing work to do co-curation, of listening to communities about representation, of addressing colonial legacies, but we don't often see that extended to Egyptian collections because they're seen as orphaned collections, divorced from the modern country, when that is a product itself
of that legacy.
Of that legacy.
Yeah, yeah.
So there is arguably even more work to do to get beyond the stereotypes, the mummies, the pharaohs, those popular images, to tell this much more complicated story.
But also, I guess, by moving the conversation, yeah, from a pure Egyptology, quote-unquote, perspective of moving the conversation beyond pharaohs, mummies, pyramids, all the usual, to actually make ancient Egypt a far more vibrant society and allowing the general public to actually access these really interesting aspects about life and death and cultural practices and religion and everything, sort of taking it outside of the tomb and that very narrow 19th and 20th century idea of what ancient Egypt was as well.
It's very much a product of our historical ways of looking, which those processes tell us more about ourselves, the way in which we've classified and dated, tells us more about ourselves than any ancient reality. And also the fact that we don't put it within the context of modern Egypt and its landscape. There are so many more ways to enliven and to tell different, more relevant stories. And I don't think that necessarily needs to detract from the wonder and awe people feel towards Egypt.
Well, indeed, it should actually enhance it, shouldn't it? Because
Absolutely. Suddenly
there's all these new ways of thinking about something I love in a way that I haven't before.
Yes. So, but it's trying to create the resources and the conversations rather than just falling back on those tropes. And we see it time and time again with temporary exhibitions, gold of the pharaohs,
yeah, treasures,
the eternal Egypt. You know, it's 2020,
yeah.
2020. So we can hopefully move more forward with more creative ways.
Well, on that note, and I know this is one of the things you'll be covering in the Sir Charles Nicholson lecture while you're in Sydney, but of course 2022 is a significant year in terms of the history of the archaeological and historical investigation of Egypt, both the bicentennial of the publication of the decipherment of hieroglyphs and the centenary of Tutankhamun's discovery. As a discipline, Egyptology, again, more broadly, or the archaeology of ancient Egypt and the way that museums engage with Egypt, how can we mark those events but then also move beyond them as well? What are some of the practices? Where should a museum that has Egyptian material culture be focusing so that we're ready for 2122?
I think by acknowledging that 1922 was also significant for Egyptians themselves, because that was the unilateral declaration of Egyptian independence when the UK recognised Egypt as a sovereign nation, and that the way in which archaeology is presented in museums and the way in which we've talked about it is entangled, and the story of Tutankhamun is entangled with those two moments, and you can't really separate them. So I think it's about trying to find ways of taking an object and its stories in multiple directions, and that is really hard for museums to do. Small text panels, limited word counts, visitor dwell time's not always great.
Yeah.
But how do we tell the fact that these objects have 100 history and 100 different worlds?
Yes.
That it exists in.
And different perspectives on each of those histories as well, too.
And that's, I don't think we've really developed a good strategy for display or interpretation yet for doing those layers of stories. But again, there must be new approaches. I don't have the answers.
Yeah,
I'm excited by the possibilities. But I think that's what museums need to be looking at, is to see these objects have existed for thousands of years, and they've existed in thousands of different contexts. Egypt has relevance for so many different people in so many different ways and places. So again, to fall back on those tropes, it's just a disservice. There's so much possibilities.
I guess this question applies equally for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander material culture and Pacific Islands material culture and a whole range of items as well. But can we decolonize Egyptian collections in places like Europe and the United States and indeed Australia, with also keeping that colonial story as part of the object biography and a part of the collection biography as well, that we learn from the mistakes of the past? Are there narratives that we can develop that actually both root the question of why this object's ended up in Sydney, for argument's sake, and yet at the same time also give the object back some degree of dignity and narrative independence from that as well?
I mean, that is the challenge, isn't it? Because, I mean, part of those issues with decolonization is it's really important to make transparent these histories, but we have to be careful not to then recenter them at the same time.
Yes.
And it may be that, the work that we're doing with Egyptian communities, that's not the story that they want to tell. Maybe there are other stories that are apart from that. So, I mean, it's going to be a process. It's just something that we just keep talking about and won't have an end, I don't think. You know, you can't decolonize. There'll only ever be continual decolonization, hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully. Please don't feel you have to name names, but I mean, as you've traveled around, have you seen museums that have actually done approaches well and have actually presented Egyptian collections in new, dynamic and interesting ways that you've gone, oh, that's actually really impressive?
This work is beginning. I think all of my colleagues who work in museums know how long it takes for things to change. So conversations around the edges, around collections with podcasts such as this, collecting initiatives to collect modern Egypt have started with colleagues. My colleague Margaret Maitland up at the National Museum of Scotland, they went to efforts to involve Egyptian voices and their video representations. Campbell Price in Manchester is working again on new approaches as they redisplay. So I think we will see new changes. Yep. I can't say I've seen anything dynamic yet, but I think Egyptology has come rather late to these conversations.
Yeah.
But there's definitely a momentum now. So I'm excited for the future.
Do you, I mean, this is a bit of an unfair question, knowing you've only been in the country for a very short period of time, but do you feel that there's potentially lessons to be learnt from the way that museums have engaged with Australian First Nations communities, for argument's sake, or First Nations communities in the Americas, where we go, right, well, is there a way of transferring aspects of that engagement? Obviously, it's not one size fits all, but are there aspects that can be transferred to the way that we deal with Egyptian North African collections, for example?
No, absolutely. So I've been very impressed, particularly by work that's being done institutionally. So we talk about decolonization, about changing the narrative, and that's often focused on display. But what I see in places, because Australia and many places in North America are more advanced in this conversation, how institutionally they are collaborating, ceding authority for other aspects like policy development, about collections policy, about how the database is constructed and priorities for working on areas. So it's much more holistic. So I think that's certainly something that colleagues can be learning from.
I want to ask you just some questions about some of the projects you've been involved with over the last decade or so, Egypt's dispersed heritage being one of them. I know that you currently have a British Academy Fellowship for a project looking at contemporary arts within museum spaces as well. Those types of projects are obviously interesting, but how do you keep the conversation going after the grant money runs out?
Oh, with a lot of goodwill, has to be said. I think the most important thing is that my colleagues in Egypt, like Heba al-Gawad, they're often on precarious contracts. A lot of people we've been working with, particularly in the community, are freelancers. It's always looking to source benefit and social benefit. Yeah. And so what I'm delighted to see, at least for Egypt's dispersed heritage, is that, for example, Nasser Jr., who we commissioned through the project, is now getting commissions outside of the project to work with museums.
Yes.
So that work has snowballed and hopefully...
Because Nasser was doing the comic strips.
So it's all the projects have threads that kind of lead to the next project. So Egypt's dispersed heritage will sort of be reincarnated, if you like, through another project beginning next month in October with the Horniman Museum and Gardens in London, where we are going to do that institutional thing of looking at how Egypt has an example of world cultures.
Yes.
I'm doing the inverted quotes thing. How that's not just thought about in display, but it's also how it's thought about in the shop, in the education team, into marketing, so that there's messaging and finding out what those different communities of practice in a museum think and need from collections and from this sort of work, and how we might change perceptions on an institutional level.
That holistic approach is really exciting, isn't it? Because otherwise, how successful can you be if you've revamped the exhibition, but then the visitor goes out to buy the same old tea towel that's been there for the last 20
the
years.
The tomb raiding game.
Yes.
The book with the man in the pith helmet on it.
Right. I guess that also segues rather nicely into a question about the two books that you've been involved in that have coming out this year. You've been very busy. The Oxford Handbook of Museum Archaeology and Egyptian Archaeology in the 21st Century Museum. congratulations on both of them, firstly. But this concept of museum archaeology that we talked about first up, what does museum archaeology mean to you?
Oh, I have a definition in my book and I wish it was on the tip of my tongue.
Sorry.
So I see museum archaeology as a sensibility. It's not just about, it's about doing archaeology in a museum, not just how archaeology is represented. And archaeology in a museum is not just about the end product of archaeology, nor just about managing the archaeology that is in museums, but about continuing to question and continuing to do interpretation with communities. And those can be collections. Some of them are, you know, held by archaeologists. Some of them are held by archaeological units, and not necessarily in museums.
Yes, yeah.
But I think that we can be curating that material with a view to under its history, its current use, and its future. And really, it's that recursive. It's context. That's what we do as archaeologists. It's about context. And that's not a static place in the field, context in a stratigraphy. It's context in its original kind of term, as Ian Hodder used it in 1986. It's about connections and interweaving. And it's tacking back and forth between object and archive. And that's what archaeology is. You know, we don't just dig up an object and go, oh, beautiful, this is dynasty. You know, what makes an object meaningful is because we can relate it to other things that help the interpretation. And that continues in a museum context through archives and photographs. And it's all that other material that archaeology produces and creates all of this material culture.
Yes.
How do you work with that? That's what museum archaeology is. It's going back to those old excavations and all material produced with it to continue conversations and interpretation.
I guess also that opportunity to reassess the material that there's often, well, you know, my field of classical, that, you know, the black and red figure vases of Greece, of course, always go on display, but actually, realistically, that's a very small representation, an incredibly small representation of the material culture being produced by Athens or wherever. All those objects on shelves in basements of museums around the globe that never get a chance to actually shine, are there ways of working them into exhibition, working them into narratives, working them into research as well?
No, absolutely. I think there's a mistaken assumption that museums are exhibitionary media. I've never seen that. I mean, museums are these fabulous repositories of resource. So, you know, getting into the store, whether these collections, as long as they can be made accessible and people can find them and use them, this is material that we can work with our students. And I think that all archaeology students should work with museum collections so that it, you know, that their, maybe their field work can hold up to historical scrutiny.
Yes.
You try working with the archaeology someone else is excavating. What can you do with it? How do you record it? And that reflexive practice should begin, and museums can help to do that. But also to recognize that those collections can mean so much to different people, whether it's with school groups, with communities, with artists, or other communities of practice. And finding those other relevancies that I think can become part of archaeological interpretation.
Yeah, it's a very interesting approach. You just mentioned artists as well, but I mean the project you're involved with in terms of contemporary art within gallery spaces of ancient Egyptian antiquities, could you talk a bit more about that? I mean, I think we're, all of our listeners are used now to the concept of an artist intervention within a space. We've done it in numerous places in the Chow Chak Wing Museum as well, but in terms of ancient Egypt, how have some of the artists that have worked with UK collections engaged, and what perspectives have they brought to the conversation that would not have been there otherwise?
So, I mean, there's obviously, we know there's a long history of artists, modern artists being inspired by Egypt. That's not necessarily what I'm looking at. It is these artistic interventions. And many listeners may know, of course, of Fred Wilson, institutional critique who did the Nefertiti busts. He has great interest in Egypt. And he had an intervention in the British Museum in 1997, where he took, for example, the old display case of the Rosetta Stone, the question, what are you looking at? And that's a great provocation for both Egyptologists and the public to really take this material and think through it critically. So I'm really interested in not necessarily how Egypt has inspired artists, but how artists might disrupt our ways of looking, thinking, and knowing about ancient Egypt. Can it? Does it? Or is it just a superficial contemporary gloss, an aesthetic to feel like we make our collections more relevant?
Yes. We're cutting edge, but, but we're not actually, we're not going to touch the real objects, if that makes sense.
So I want to talk to artists that have been working in museum spaces with Egyptian archaeology and looking at some of previous projects from the British Museum through to Turin and Munich, where they have tried this, and just to see how effective and what messages came from that.
Have there been many contemporary Egyptian artists that have been involved with European museums, or is it largely European visual artists? Because do we run the risk of a new level of colonialism to a degree?
Yeah, no, absolutely. This is one of the problems. So one of the first was Time Machine at the British Museum in 1994. It's one of the case studies I'll be looking at. And they only had one Egyptian artist in it. So that, I think, is certainly an issue that we'll be examining. But there's a great movement in Egypt now, a lot of contemporary artists working, but a lot of questioning about the effectiveness or appropriateness of that. So there's conversations in Egypt amongst Egyptians who are, again, I think will bring a fresh perspectives that we can learn from.
You're listening to Object Matters, the podcast of the Chow Chak Wing Museum. My guest for this episode is Associate Professor Alice Stevenson. Alice, now, again, very unfair question, because you've only been in Australia for only a number of days at the time we're recording this as well. But I guess seeing Egyptian and other antiquities in a museum in Sydney, you know, literally on the other side of the globe, there is a certain rational logic in terms of colonial histories as to why there would be museum collections in Britain and France and Germany and the United States. But, you know, seeing that dispersal of collections globally, have you found during your research Egyptian antiquities in very odd places and, you know, extraordinary areas that you wouldn't have thought of otherwise?
No, it is extraordinary. I mean, our project Artifacts of Excavation showed about 350 institutions in 27 countries across all of
the globe,
all the continents apart from Antarctica, that have these Egyptian collections and so many different motivations. So yes, I found collections, you know, in Ghana and in Jamaica and in Japan, but also I found them at the bottom of a dirt track road on the, you know, outside of Cape Town in homemade museum. They've been at their own Masonic lodges. The Queen had some material. Perhaps the White House. I've tracked that one down.
There
was even an American president that paid money into the Egypt Exploration Fund.
Wow, extraordinary.
So it's extraordinary, the breadth of interest.
But I was always the story of the mummified human remains that ended up in one of the football stadiums in New Orleans that was technically the only Egyptian mummified person to have ever seen a Super Bowl back in the 1970s or something.
I did not know that. I'll
try and find the reference for you.
But
just those extraordinary voyages. And, of course, from a museum perspective or a cultural institution perspective, those modern object biographies are just as important to the story of the object as its original antiquity setting. How do you work some of those narratives into your research?
I think, well, I always come back to one of the things is it's doing archaeology better. This isn't just tacking on an interesting story, because what these stories reveal is how we know. You know, construction of knowledge is something we look at a lot in the history and philosophy of science. But it's fundamentally looking at the periods when an object came out, was known, and the words that get used around it that get sedimented, you know, fossilized into our understanding. So, you know, certain things, like, for example, in the Petrie Museum, we have tip cats. We all know what a tip cat is, right? No. It's a Victorian toy. Because this is, they've never seen, it's like a little wooden shuttle. It's very unassuming.
Yeah.
But it was obvious to Flinders Petrie that this was a tip cat, because in Victorian London, that was a toy at the time.
Right.
But it shows his thinking. It's from a Middle Kingdom settlement.
Yeah.
And so it shows that he is imagining this Middle Kingdom settlement in terms of Victorian London. And it shapes his interpretation. And yet we still call these things,
and that
imposes an interpretation.
Yeah.
If you go back to the history, the time and the thinking behind it, you go, okay, there's actually no good archaeological reason for that name. They might not even be toys.
Yes.
So it's that working back and unpicking assumptions. And you start looking at different things, even dating, which you think is objective, and see that it's come from not just Victorian science, but Victorian assumption.
I mean, it's really interesting, because I guess even if they are toys, it's the idea of what Victorian childhood was like, which, of course, is so radically different to childhood today, but back into ancient millennia as well. So it's creating those sort of false assumptions just by terminology.
Yeah, and it's actually baked into the heart of our disciplines. Mm. And you just, but once you see something, you can't unsee it.
Having had a look around the Chow Chak Wing Museum collection, is there any, I mean, obviously we've ended up with Egyptian material from a range of sources, both Sir Charles Nicholson himself in the middle of the 19th century through sponsorship arrangements with the Egyptian Exploration Fund and then Society, and obviously also through Australian soldiers and nurses during the World War One Gallipoli campaign. Has there been anything that you've kind of stopped and gone, yeah, that's really an interesting piece? Or, sorry, I'm not meaning to put you on the spot here, but is there, you know, anything that sort of jumped out at you in terms of what you've seen so far?
I'm trying to, I mean, I have to say that I was very confronted by some of the human remains that yep. I saw. I think that's one of the things that sticks in my mind.
Yep.
Body parts, which I have to say I didn't expect in an Australian museum, given Aboriginal concerns, First Nations concerns over how their remains have been used. Mm. To again, just perhaps not seen care. I'm a bit reluctant. I don't want to the first thing I say to
be
critique.
Yeah.
But I find that quite confronting. But I think a lot of it's very similar. It's a university museum. And obviously, I have worked primarily in university yes. museums, so there's things that are very similar, but also different. I think one of the things that, particularly for the stories for Australia, is how acquiring this material was less about acquiring from Egypt and how proud collectors were to have got something from mm. Britain,
mm.
and that these were seen as somehow more British because they were British acquisitions,
yes, yes.
and that they could be part of this great great colonial endeavor or archaeological endeavor. So those sorts of stories of pride come across, I think, even more strongly mm. through some of the collections here.
That's a really interesting perspective. I must say I've always been quite fascinated by this concept, and again, it fits within the colonial and indeed racist mm. perspective of the era, but the idea of as a colony so far away from the center of action in Europe, we needed material culture to show that we belonged to part of that European ancestry. So what better way to do that than by using Egyptian antiquities, and that we were therefore the inheritors of this deep past, completely ignoring the fact that there was an 80,000-year-old tradition
yep.
literally on the ground in which we're standing, and just that real disconnect between the Sydney intellectual community of the time that was establishing a museum and actually asking some really interesting questions, but then having this complete sort of shutdown in terms of history was very linear and very narrative, and that we were part of it, and that the British Empire was the successor of this long tradition going back to the Egyptian pharaohs.
Mm, very much so. We see similar thing in South Africa, where people were acquiring Egyptian objects and they were writing letters to London saying, well, we have no history. We need these antique pieces here yeah. in South Africa, in this new nation,
yes, yes.
to, you know, bind us this great historical civilization narrative.
And yet
narrative.
The early hominid skulls were being found yeah. not long after in the very same yeah. areas.
And ignoring the history of the local inhabitants.
So again, from a museum's perspective, how can we work some of those narratives in? That's a lot of very high-end concepts for a 300-word label.
Yeah.
How do we actually challenge some of those notions? Can we use things like audios and videos as part of the presentation?
Yeah, storytelling. I think I was very impressed at the Museum of Sydney with its introduction of, you know, and there are we see this, and this is Egyptians are great storytellers. So I think that narrative format of telling stories, whether that's film or video or oral testimony, can be done really powerfully. And we don't have to fill galleries with lots of things. One object can be a starting point for different perspectives. And, you know, there's this idea of the gateway object, which I always quite like, this idea that one object can be used to open up broader themes. So you don't need a busy case with lots and lots of labels and lots of narratives. One object might have relevance in different places, and how we might use that to tell something a bit surprising. It's a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and it also has relevance here. But again, these are all things that still need to be evaluated. There's a lot of scholarship and ideas, and a lot of what I've written is ideas, but we know in museums that curators may have ideas. It's not necessarily going to be how they are received.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And people will bring different lived experience.
And I guess part of it is also about museums themselves individually developing their own style, because I guess if we all go off and do the same thing, then actually from a visitor perspective, it's like, well, that's great, but I've seen it down the road. So.
Yeah.
Are there any takeaway thoughts that you would like visitors to the Chow Chak Wing Museum who are seeing the Egyptian antiquities, completely decontextualized from not just Egypt, but also from that colonial setting as well to some degree, what would you like people to think about when they're actually viewing exhibitions in our spaces that feature Egyptian antiquities?
To really think about where they come from, which is Egypt, which is where they were from, where they were made meaningful, and where they still have meaning. And so I think it's that, you know, these objects have existed through different times and places, but I think that process of re-landscaping it with the people and place of Egypt, I think that's been missing, because we've very much taken Egypt's art historically and cut it off from the landscape and the people.
When you return to Britain, I mean, you talked before about your project starting in October, but when you return to Britain, what's next?
Gosh, well, apart from back into teaching, but preparing for this project at the Horniman Museum, there'll be a series of focus groups with various different departments in the Horniman to understand how they use and their need. Also starting up projects with conversations with communities in Egypt through Heba, and also trying to get my head into contemporary art, which is a very different intellectual space and one that I'm quite daunted, it has to be said.
Well, good luck. I look forward to seeing the results of that project in particular. But congratulations on both of the books out this year as well.
Thank you
so much for your time and for joining me on Object Matters.
It's been a great conversation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Object Matters is recorded on the grounds of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. The University of Sydney and the Chow Chak Wing Museum wishes to pay our respects to the traditional owners of the lands upon which we work.
Subscribe to Object Matters on your favourite podcast app and connect with the Chow Chak Wing Museum on Instagram, Twitter and Facebook. You can also subscribe to our monthly e-newsletter, Muse Extra, via our website, sydney.edu.au/museum.